Our next case for argument this morning is REI Transport against C.H. Robinson Worldwide.
Morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Howard.
May it please the Court. My name is James Howard. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Brown and James, and I'm here to represent REI Transport, Inc., a drayage carrier who operates out of Waterloo, Illinois. Now, our claim before this Court is a breach of contract action against C.H. Robinson, a transportation broker or self-proclaimed travel agent for freight. Now, we don't need to go through the extensive facts. Obviously, they've been briefed in detail. But the keys of this case are simply that C.H. Robinson submitted a contract to REI for signature. We agreed to provide certain drayage services to them under that contract. Under the contract, it provided that in case of a loss, REI would only be held responsible for losses that occurred while they were in control of the goods. It also provided that C.H. Robinson had the right to withhold some of our payments, also if the loss occurred under this contract or while we were in possession of those goods. No losses ever occurred in this matter or in any other matter where losses occurred while REI was in control of any of C.H. Robinson's transportation goods. Now, a loss that's been raised in the issue here was a subject loss that occurred while a load was under the control of Union Pacific Railroad. On its way to Dupo, Illinois, were under a separate contract, REI Transport agreed to pick up the load and transport it the remaining to its destination of Marion, Illinois. Now, after this loss was discovered, C.H. Robinson came to REI and demanded payment. When we refused to settle, they decided to keep our monies, claiming under the contract they had the right to do so. But this obviously is in violation of those contract terms. This breach of contract action followed to recover the $81,000 that had been withheld. C.H. Robinson, in response, filed a counterclaim under the 49 U.S.C. 14706, otherwise known as the Carmack Amendment, claiming that we were liable as a delivering carrier. Now, in the district court's order, the court ruled that our breach of contract action was preempted by the Carmack Amendment. Now, from my reading of this order, we feel this is an erroneous ruling. We can find no case law anywhere, nowhere in the statute, does anything ever apply to carrier actions against a shipper. Now, in this case, C.H. Robinson was a broker. They've alleged an assignment.
See what any of this has to do with the subject. The Carmack Amendment supersedes contract exculpatory clauses of the kind that's here. Whether you call that preemption or not doesn't matter much. So the central question is whether this part of the shipment was covered by the Carmack Amendment. Now, your brief says that it's not, because this was not on a through bill of lading, that there were three separate bills of lading.
Correct.
Robinson says that was forfeited because that argument was never made in the district court. So I think that's where we need to go. Was such an argument made in the district court?
It was not, Your Honor.
It was not. Well, but we're right. It was forfeited.
We've maintained throughout this action that Carmack has no applicability to our breach of contract action. And in fact, we feel that the ruling by the lower court was incorrect in stating so. And our development of this three separate contract argument, which has always existed in our mind, is also based on C.H. Robinson's continual reliance on this court's decision in Temple Steel v. Landstar. Now, C.H. Robinson interprets that case to say that the carrier, defendant in that case, Landstar, stands in the same shoes as REI Transport does in this case. From my reading of that case, I disagree. I believe that, in fact, in that case, Landstar, the defendant carrier, actually is in the same shoes of C.H. Robinson in this matter. The issues raised by the court in their judgment was that Landstar touted its seamless service of transport, that it presented itself to the shipper as a company that can get the job done, transportation from the beginning to end. They were the chosen carrier by the shipper. And that's the position C.H. Robinson has in this.
I don't see what difference it can possibly make. It's subrogated to the rights of Circuit City. And there's no problem with a subrogated agent making a claim under the Carmack Amendment.
I'm not arguing that point, Your Honor. In fact, we argued that point in the district court and failed.
So the argument you're making is entirely irrelevant given that Robinson is subrogated to Circuit City's rights.
Well, Your Honor, and I'd like to be a little verbose. I'm not getting to my point very quickly. I will, sir. In the Landstar case, this court ruled that Landstar had the ability to protect itself from further liability for further transportation down the line, but it chose not to do so. It had the ability to send out new bills of lading if it was worried about a future carrier down the line screwing something up. That ability was there, and they chose not to do it. And that's actually, in fact, what C.H. Robinson did in this case. And I know we've talked about the claim that Comerc doesn't apply under the three contract action. That's based on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Ryder. And the Landstar case, although not citing Ryder, is based on that same logic. The same logic stating that privity between these carriers is what's key here, is what's key to determine if there was or was not a through bill of lading. And in Landstar, there was privity. We had Landstar who contracted with these other carriers down the line, and Landstar was therefore held responsible under Carmack.
Privity can't possibly be relevant. The idea of the Carmack Amendment is that the shipper can recover for the loss from either the originating carrier or the terminating carrier. The shipper never is in privity of contract with the terminating carrier. The bill of lading is negotiated with the originating carrier.
But under the Ryder decision, that privity determines if a through bill of lading exists. And what Ryder tells us, and I understand the facts are different because there's an international shipment, but here what we're discussing is the analysis used in Ryder. The issue in Ryder, as I'm sure you're aware, shipment came from Argentina, stops in New Orleans, new bill of lading is issued for the domestic part. In that case, they're trying to say, well, there was a through bill of lading starting, it's an international shipment, Carmack doesn't apply. The court held there was no privity between the ocean carrier and the domestic carrier, meaning it was not a through solid bill of lading. Instead, it was two separate independent contracts for two separate independent shipments. And that's what we have here.
You've just told me that this argument you've now come to was never made in the district court. It's been forfeited. It's gone.
Well, I think it's a straight transition from the C.H. Robinson's continued reliance on the Landstar case, which uses the same logic that Ryder v. Thompson does. And if we should just rely solely on Temple Steel v. Landstar, that's perfectly fine as well. It's that same logic that applies here, that there must be a connection between these carriers. If not, Carmack does not apply to the entire shipment.
Let me ask you, I'm just trying to understand factually here how someone in your position protects himself. And maybe I'm wrong here, and you help me if I am. These seal numbers were changed. So when you accepted this in Illinois to be delivered up to Marion, Illinois, or something, when you accepted it there, these things didn't jive.
That's correct.
So isn't that the time to... I'm talking... If you're in the business here, that you protect yourself and say, I won't accept delivery of this because the seals have been changed, the numbers have been changed. So obviously something has gone haywire along, as it did here in El Paso.
And if that had occurred, Your Honor, if that seal had been noted, then we wouldn't be here today.
Yeah.
But it was a minor oversight of not being checked.
Well, it wasn't a minor oversight. It turned out to be a big oversight.
But the fact still remains that the loss occurred under an independent contract held by C.H. Robinson with Union Pacific.
Yeah. The way the Carmack Amendment works, just like the way the check processing system works, the last person in line is liable, and it then reverses the payment through the system. The problem, I gather, following up on Judge Evans, is that REI just didn't notice that the change in seal occurred on Union Pacific's watch, and therefore didn't act within the time it had to reverse the payment.
Well, we were notified within a short period of time after, not that short period of time. We were given notice of the loss, and our immediate response was, it wasn't us. We didn't do it. Let's investigate this issue. Let's find out where it happened. Let's move forward and determine where it really occurred.
But as Judge Easterbrook says, you're on the hook because you accepted it with the same seal number that was on it originally, and that was the actual seal number that was on it.
That's true.
So don't you have some recourse against Union Pacific here?
We do, actually, and in the district court, actually, we filed for a motion to join Union Pacific, and that was denied. We currently have a companion case filed in St. Clair against Union Pacific on that same basis.
It seems like that's where you get made whole if it wasn't your fault.
Well, you are. I hopefully that will work out that way. We hope so. But I still think the issue is that Carmack does not apply to this case because of the setup of C.H. Robinson. C.H. Robinson independently has individual shippers out there looking for the best prices for C.H. Robinson, for C.H. Robinson's customers. So they use these individual contracts, individual separate movements.
Make this argument in the district court.
Very true. I think it is an extension based on the arguments raised by.
It's not remotely related to the arguments you made in the district court.
We're on, just for my time, as I want to. Other than the Carmack issue, if we look to the breach of contract itself, is an action against by us by the carrier against the shipper. Carmack has no involvement here. The money was taken and held by C.H. Robinson without our authorization and without any right to do so under the contract terms. The contract terms clearly point out they're allowed to withhold money only when a loss occurs under this contract, and that's not what occurred in this case. And just arguing the alternative, if Carmack is held to be applied, there also has been no issue of – there's been no prima facie case established in this case to warrant summary judgment motion at this time. Based on this court's decision in Allied Tube and PharmaBio, when the first element is at issue, that the stuff was not delivered in a good condition, and that has not been proven by C.H. Robinson at this point. They've raised evidence of, with an affidavit and testimony saying, well, I was the guy in charge and it would have been done, but he has no necessarily any recollection of that load. Now, in the Allied Tube case, the court after a bench trial that was held to be sufficient after it was able to be interpreted in his.
I don't understand where you're going with this.
In what regard?
Are you saying this is all made up by Circuit City? They never put the DVDs on the.
We're saying that's a possibility, at least for a trial, have a trial to let a fact finder decide. Because all that's been offered to this point is someone saying, well, I would have done it. I might have done it. I don't remember doing it. I might have done it. And there's also an issue, which is you've seen in the record, of a police officer in California who discovered some DVD players that Circuit City matched somehow to this load. Now, that issue also needs to be fully vetted and investigated and put in front of the court, in front of a jury, to let them make the decision.
But these DVDs were loaded in Walnut Creek, California.
And they were discovered, and the stolen goods were discovered in Los Angeles. So not very far away, and it's an issue that needs to have a fact finder decide if that has been established. And like I said, in Allied Tube, we have an issue. A trial judge determined that the testimony was enough and gave him that inference that it was loaded properly. And then in PharmaBio, we have a case where an affidavit was held to be sufficient to present a genuine issue of material fact. That was actually a case argued by opposing counsel in this. And it was his client, the carrier, who was originally granted summary judgment on this basis that not enough evidence had been offered, and that was later reversed, stating that an affidavit from the owner of the company on the loading procedures was sufficient to raise an issue for the jury. And that, Your Honor, is what we're asking for, is a chance to take this case in front of a jury. I'll reserve my last few seconds for rebuttal unless you have any more questions.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Steiner.
Thank you. Good morning, Judge Easterbrook, Judge Flom, Judge Evans. May it please the court, I'm Joel Steiner. I represent C.H. Robinson. Given your comments, I would say the case here is really all about an unjustified refusal to pay a freight loss claim, nothing more. And as you've observed, the principal assignment of error is that the district court failed to give credence to a legal theory that was never placed before it. I'm not going to, unless you wish me to, direct any of my prepared comments to that legal theory, since I agree it doesn't apply. I would point out, however, that one of your questions was, were there three bills of lading? No, there were not. There was one single bill of lading from Walnut, California to Marion, Illinois. There was also nothing in the record about any contract between C.H. Robinson and any entities other than Circuit City and REI Transport. So that part of the argument, I think, has to go away as well. With respect to what the district court did regarding the contract, first of all, the contract in Article 9 had the forbidden contrary to Carmack provision. That's what the district court struck down. Article 3 of the contract, I believe it's the second paragraph, doesn't say that Robinson can withhold money if under the contract there's a cargo claim or if there's a loss while it's in possession of REI. It says if REI unjustifiably refuses to pay a claim. It, of course, is our position that REI was liable under Carmack and therefore its refusal to pay the claim was not justified. With respect to the prima facie case, as we've just noted, REI challenges only the first prong. The three prongs, of course, are you gave it to a carrier in good condition. Here, the quantity, not the condition, since it's a loss, not a damage case. Two, it was delivered in off condition. And three, the amount of the damages. So they're not questioning that there was something missing on delivery. They're not questioning the amount. With respect to the prima facie case, the district court found that our evidence was unrebutted. That is correct. With respect to the affidavit, you were present as well as I in the PharmaBio case, and what the court told me at that time was, you can't challenge this affidavit on a credibility basis with nothing at all to rebut it. We have Mr. Barker's affidavit, which is supported by his...
Totally lost. Are you relying on something in an opinion of the court?
In PharmaBio, the reversal was based... The district court found in my favor in PharmaBio...
Your favor? Were you...
I represented the motor carrier in PharmaBio.
Not in your favor.
The district court did. In my client's favor.
You are not a litigant.
In my client's favor. Yeah. I'll leave that. I don't want to confuse the court. Our evidence here...
Some language in the court's opinion in PharmaBio that you're relying on, I'd be happy to have you draw it to my attention. But whether you played any role in it is completely irrelevant.
In PharmaBio at page 918, we will not grant summary judgment in favor of TNT based on TNT's attack on the credibility of an affiant whose affidavit otherwise shows there are genuine issues of material fact. Here, it's the same...
Law.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
That's black-letter law. It didn't require PharmaBio.
Here... There is nothing to contradict the Abarca affidavit. In fact, he was deposed, and his deposition testimony is consistent. It's not, oh, I don't remember. It's he identified the documents relative to the specific shipment. I identified his own handwriting on them. I identified the initials of his co-workers, tied the quantities of goods and the model numbers to the bill of lading. This was direct evidence, not just circumstantial evidence, and I believe that that establishes a prima facie case beyond any doubt, and there is no issue of fact whatsoever. If they wish to create an issue of fact with respect to whether or not those goods were loaded, they needed to come forward with someone who observed the loading and said, "No, I don't think all the pallets got on that truck." And that's a misstatement because this wasn't a palletized load, as Mr. Abarca testified. He remembered that as well. If you read his deposition transcript, he remembered quite well, through the review of the documents, what happened there. So there's no rebuttal of the fact that it was loaded. There's no dispute of the fact of what quantity arrived in Illinois. And there is no dispute as to the amount. Judge Murphy's summary judgment was correct and proper in all material respects and should be affirmed. Are there any other questions you might have, Your Honors?
Thank you very much, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Further, Mr. Howard, you've probably got about 23 seconds.
In those 23 seconds, Your Honor, I'll say that we've taken a big, pretty big jump in this affidavit we've been talking about, Mr. Barca, coming to the fact that it's established fact based on his testimony. His affidavit says, I have personal knowledge of the information contained herein. He testified prior that he did not have any recollection of this particular load or loading it. Now, this exact same thing happened in PharmaBio, exactly, where the affidavit states that the witness had personal knowledge but testified he could not possibly remember. His credibility is a determination he made by the finder of fact, not on summary judgment. That's all we're asking for here, Your Honors, for this to be put in front of a jury and let the jury decide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Counsel. The case is taken under advisement.